Hello, and welcome to the Doorstops Podcast with Dr. Cody Price. In case you've missed it, previous and future episodes of the Doorstops Podcast can be found on Audioboom, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Please be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe to the Doorstops Podcast so that you don't miss any updates about housing issues in Ohio. You can also follow the podcast and other research that the Office of Housing Policy at the Ohio Housing Finance Agency does by following our Twitter account at Ohio Doorsteps. Well, let's get started. I'm Dr. Cody Price, and I'd like to introduce you all to my guest today, Bruce Lukey. Bruce is the president and CEO of Homeport, which is a nonprofit housing developer based here in Columbus, Ohio. And so I want to start off by thanking you for coming in today.
Thanks, Cody. I would appreciate the invitation. It's always good to spend time with OFA and talk about the affordable housing issues.
Great. So before we kind of dive in, can you kind of tell us a little bit more about Homeport, which for those of you that don't know, is also known as the Columbus Housing Partnership?
Thanks, Cody. We were started back in 1987 as Columbus Housing Partnership. We were started by civic leaders as well as the city. And so the city, James Rouse from Enterprise, a number of real estate investors at the time. So the Schottensteins, the Weilers, the Kellys, all those names that would sound familiar as well as the foundation and the realtors. We were started, interestingly, at the exact same time the shelter board was started. And so the shelter board, obviously, to deal with short-term housing needs. And then really Columbus Housing Partnership back then to deal with longer-term affordable housing needs. We have, since that time, over the past 31 years, developed roughly 5,000 or so housing units. Today, we have 35 communities, roughly 2,400 units, and over 6,200 people live with us.
And can you kind of tell me about those units that you have, what type of services that you guys kind of focus on or provide at these developments?
Sure. So first, let me talk about the units. It's a mix. We have both multifamily as well as single family. And single family breaks down into both lease option homes as well as for sale homes. For the 6,200 people that individuals that live with us, our main concern is community, family, and individual sustainability and security and stability. We provide service coordination for those residents. What that really means is that we have social workers that are placed out in our communities. They work one-on-one with our clients, and they identify issues and needs that our clients may have and then refer them to the most appropriate resource and then follow up after the fact. We also have housing developments that touch a variety of demographics. So we have now 4 to 5 senior housing units. Those are multifamily. We have family housing developments. And then we have, along with that family housing developments, we have, you know, a number of kids. In fact, half our portfolio are kids. In addition to the service coordination, the regular service coordination that I described before, we also have some very targeted programs. So, for example, for our seniors, we partner with National Church Residences. National Church Residences, who's an expert in seniors and health, provide a lot of the service coordination for our senior independent sites. And then we work with other partners like Boys and Girls Club as well as a couple other organizations to help us provide youth services, either at our site or adjacent to our sites.
Kind of where are you developing? So where are these units, these buildings, these projects really located?
Sure. We are a Central Ohio focused. We have, in fact, not stepped out of Central Ohio. We're in probably 3 counties of Central Ohio, but we're pretty much scattered throughout the whole area. You know, draw a circle from where we're sitting here today, or draw a string around the circle. We're there in some way, and that includes both within the city as well as in suburbs.
You're kind of talking about the family housing, kind of looking at, would you consider a lot of this being workforce housing? Like, who are you kind of targeting income-wise?
So most of our developments have been financed through the low-income housing tax credit, thanks to OFA and working with OFA, which means most, with the exception of our senior communities, most of the individuals that live with us do work. I would probably put them, you know, just in terms of area median income, maybe the sweet spot is between 30 and 60% of area median income. So most do work. That's really our focus. You talked a little bit about workforce. To us, workforce is slightly different than some of the LIHTC development that we've been doing. In fact, we're starting now to expand into workforce. So our definition, and there's many of them in the marketplace, our definition of workforce housing really serves the needs of those individuals from an AMI perspective, you know, at 60% of area median income, up to 100% of area median income. And we've really only recently just started to get into that space. And it's really for two different reasons. The first reason is because we're Central Ohio focused and really don't plan to go outside of the area because we think there's enough of a need here in Central Ohio. While the tax credit financing is, you know, just an excellent financing alternative, it's a finite resource. And so we know that, you know, we'll only be able to get, you know, so many credits. So number one, we're limited in that regard, right? And so as we looked at different alternatives, what we saw was that in the Central Ohio marketplace, which is growing rapidly, rents are growing at least twice what incomes are growing. The other demographic that's really starting to get squeezed are working people whose rents are growing faster than what their incomes are. So those, that 60 to 100% AMI. And so this is really an extension, I guess, of our mission now to also get into that space. We're certainly not abandoning, you know, LIHTC development, but we're expanding our mission.
And so what do you think are your strengths with developing workforce housing? So you're moving into this new market, you're expanding your mission. So what is it that you do really well with developing?
First of all, I would say a lot of what we, you know, a lot of our strengths for, you know, for workforce housing or that extension of our mission goes back to what our strengths are already. We've been in the business for 31 years. You know, we're a reliable, strong developer. We build quality product. We know how to asset manage that product. We know how to keep it, you know, tip top and make sure that our residents are being served. So number one, that. Secondly, we're used to dealing with complex capital structures. In fact, I would say that, you know, affordable housing is even more complex than some of the workforce. It's very complex just based upon the capital stack. We have very strong relationships with that we've built over the years. So we work very closely. We're not a general contractor. And so we work very closely with a number of general contractors. So we have those relationships. We work very closely with the governments, you know, whether that's the city, the county, the suburbs, et cetera. We have those relationships. And then funding partners. We have a lot of relationships with a number of different traditional and non-traditional funding partners. Just to give you an example, and which was really a benefit for one of our longer-term and largest multifamily properties, we refinanced it a couple years ago with a PRI from the Columbus Foundation.
And what is the PRI?
So a PRI, the best way for me to describe it would be a grant with an interest rate attached. It's like a loan, but it's coming from the foundation. But it was a $3.3 million PRI at 3%. So there are social dollars that are available. Just being able, you know, to use a tool like that allowed us to lower our debt costs in that area and pump another $1 million back into the development and bring it up to speed. So there are social dollars that are out there, and we work with a number of different sources there.
And so what do you see as being your biggest challenges for developing housing in Central Ohio?
It's a great question because there's probably as many. part of it is market driven. You know, I talked a little bit about capital, but, you know, what's needed to make these deals work, particularly the workforce housing, is some level of lower cost equity and lower cost debt. And whereas there are individuals or organizations who are willing to take a little bit lower return than your typical market rate equity investment, there still isn't a lot of capital out there. So capital, number one, is a big issue. Number two, just making the numbers work and the economics work. Typically speaking, you know, land costs are not going down, they're going up. You know, putting these type of housing units near businesses that have a number of workers in that space. So just, you know, think about the, you know, the Southeast corridor with Rickenbacker, or think about what, you know, Amazon and, you know, has come in here with distribution centers and doing. Trying to find land is difficult, and when you do find it, it's expensive. And so making the numbers work and still trying to keep rents low but still build a quality product, it's a tough thing to do.
And so you were kind of talking about the financing structure and how that's kind of one of your biggest challenges. And so how has this really changed throughout the years since its inception? You were saying 1987?
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, that's kind of right around when the LIHTC program kind of started. But how were you seeing this transition of funding mechanism for your developments and property?
I'm only going to be able to partially answer the question because I wasn't with Homeport back then. I was actually on the other side of the table. I was a banker. And I think the issue today is, so just right off the bat, and this, you know, this is a good, it's a good thing at the end of the day, but there's more competition, right? There's some, you know, just awfully good developers who do a lot of the things, same things we do. And that's a good thing, right? I mean, because the need is large enough to absorb all the developers. You know, on the other side of that, there's a lot more competition from a funding perspective, right? And so, you know, being able to kind of make sure we stay on top of the market, can get deals, is really important. The other, you know, the other thing, though, that it's led us to do is look at how to be more creative about how we do some of these things. We don't always have to do them by ourselves. In fact, we've built up some wonderful relationships with for-profit developers where we've been partners in their deals. And in fact, we have you know, a couple right now that we're working on that we haven't announced yet, but a couple that we're working on right now that, you know, are really nice partnerships. And the benefit to those is, particularly in the workforce housing space, is that we can create mixed income housing developments. As a nonprofit and housing developer, we have access in many cases to funding that those organizations don't, or lower cost funding. But that lower cost funding also has strings attached to it, right? So there has to be affordability in the deal. And so I think that's the next stage in what we're seeing here. There has to be more partnerships. There has to be more creativity, you know, to continue to do the things we do.
And so we were talking earlier about like some of these partnerships with, and then those partnerships having attachments to services. So can you speak a little bit more about tenant services that you might offer on site, or connections that you're making with the tenants to outside resources?
Yeah, sure. So first of all, so for our portfolio today, again, since half our population are kids and the parents are working, making sure they have something to do after school or in the summer, it becomes very important, not just to keep them busy and to have programs, but to feed them, to make sure that, you know, we're reinforcing what they're learning at school, and this is one of the, I think, just, you know, great opportunities, is to provide experiences to them. In many cases, a lot of the kids who live with us, they rarely go out of the six blocks of their neighborhood where they live. So just taking a trip to the zoo or to the state house or, you know, to Chase or to, you know, anywhere like that, it just opens their eyes. And it's so fun to watch because something we need to do. You know, for seniors, this partnership with National Church Residents is so important because we want them to, our units are independent living. We want them to be able to live as independently as possible for as long as they possibly can. And so having that kind of partnership is big. But you know, other things, we're spending more and more time with, for example, job training organizations and linking our individuals to job opportunities and training. That is, at the end of the day, if we're, you know, we can build, but we can't build out of an affordable housing crisis, right? Income becomes a really important part of that. And so the more we can either both educate as well as expose our residents to opportunities where they can increase their income, the better they'll be.
Can you also talk a little bit about EmpowerBus and kind of what that is? And
so, you know, interesting, I was just introduced to EmpowerBus, and it came out of the Columbus Foundation's program, their discussions, the big table. I met Aislinn, and in fact, she came in to meet with us the other day because I was so intrigued by what they did. They're kind of the best way for me to describe it is they're, you know, they're really learning to understand the unique issues that their potential clients have and then how transportation helps them. And in many cases, you know, what they're doing is reminiscent to what the Google buses do in San Francisco with Google, you know, paying for transportation for its own employees. So we're still working with EmpowerBus to figure out the best way to do it. But what we have and what they're excited about is we have a lot of residents in one place, right? Mm-hmm. And particularly as we grow forward and look at workforce opportunities that could be near businesses, then the, you know, linking transportation and housing will start to become a pretty powerful thing. Because transportation, you know, the cost of transportation, you know, I almost consider it as a cost of housing. And so I think they're doing some neat things to be able to lower the cost of transportation and to make that last mile really important to get people to and from work.
And so I know we kind of mentioned it a little bit earlier, but with one of the programs that you guys do, it's you guys call it Lease Option. It's also been called Lease Purchase Program. And so can you kind of explain to our listeners about what this program is, what it's about?
Sure. So Lease Purchase Homes is, and it's a business we've been in for quite a while. In fact, we have 535 homes, single-family homes. It is a, you know, low-income housing tax credit financed program, but instead of multifamily properties, they're single-family homes. And everything else is kind of roughly the same. So we build single-family homes, and they remain as rental units for 15 years. At the end of that compliance period, at the end of 15 years, they're eligible to be purchased, typically and hopefully, by the people who have been living in them and renting them, you know, over the years. You know, the success of lease option homes is driven, quite frankly, by, you know, where they sit. In some cases, we've been fortunate to be able to build almost like subdivisions, right? Houses right next to each other. And you know, so when you get to that 15 years, they typically sell faster because you sort of have a, you know, built-in neighborhood there. In many cases, they're scattered. On one end, that's a positive thing for, you know, the city and the county because they have a number of land bank properties. The land banks are typically where we buy a number of the properties to be able to build on. But the downside of that is they sit next to random other houses, right? And so you don't have the strength of neighborhood necessarily that you do. We did something a little bit different with the last lease purchase deal we did, which is in Milo Grogan, which we 33 homes we just finished at the end of last year. We raised funds working with Fifth Third Bank and with Ohio Capital Corp to also be able to, you know, to do home repair to the houses next to the new houses that were being built. So it's almost got a dual purpose. It's helping the individuals who have lived there quite a long time, right, and helping them with improvements with homes, which in many cases they couldn't necessarily afford. But quite frankly, it also keeps the real estate up. And you know, and if I'm considering buying a home, I want to buy a home. I want to buy a good home, and I want to buy it in a, you know, an area that's comfortable for me. Having said that, lease purchases, it's a tough business. There are, you know, a small number of organizations like ours who have done well selling it. One of those is CHN or Cleveland Housing Network. And it's a combination of things. So today, we've probably now had 90 to 100 homes that have been eligible to be purchased. We've probably only sold about 20 to 25% of those. Now, that differs because we have one location where we've sold 80 to 85% of the homes because they've you know, kind of been all adjacent to each other, but some of the scattered are hard to sell. So there's a couple complicating factors that come into play. So number one, I just talked all about the real estate. Number two is in 15 years, your family changes quite a bit, right? So in many cases, these individuals got into these single family homes because they needed three or four bedrooms. After 15 years, they might not need three or four bedrooms any longer, right? Now, they don't have to stay there the whole time, right? They move, but we do some things for the people who lease from us. So every year that they lease, we give them a $1,000 credit toward purchasing the home. At the end of 15 years, we want to make sure that the home they're moving into is solid and stable, which usually means we take care of the major things, so a roof or, you know, new air conditioning or heating system, the things that would be major expenses. But from day one, you know, they're cutting the grass. They're taking care of the house. We have programs that, you know, help them learn how to do those things. And then the last thing we do in preparing people to move into a home is we have a very robust financial education program, both home buyer education as well as, you know, learning to be a better manager of money and assets. And that helps individuals do two things. One, it gets them ready for the transaction. So we have to start 4 or 5 years ahead of time to start doing that. But, you know, and that's critically important. But I would also tell you that the same thing, and it may even be more important, is we also need to make sure that people are aware of what it takes to sustain a house over time. And the last thing that we would want to do is sell a house to someone who doesn't have the capabilities to take care of it. That's just a lose-lose all the way around. And so we, you know, kind of try to surround them with all these items to make sure that we're, you know, they're buying something and they're comfortable with it. And we have some great stories. We were just out last week with Joyce Main, who's 75 years old, and she, you know, she bought her first house. Hardworking, pleasant lady. Her husband unfortunately died a year ago, but, you know, kind of set her up to be able to do this. She sees it as, you know, not only a place for her, and she's been renting it for years, but also a place for her children to, you know, it's something that she's done for her family. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to hear those kind of stories is just really kind of neat.
Yeah. And so, I mean, you were talking a lot about that the clustering of the homes is doing a lot better, the scattered site, maybe not so much, but it's just like when you're looking at the demographics that are living in there, I mean, you're saying that these homes are typically like 3 to 4 bedrooms. And as we were saying, that you can't really purchase until year 15. And a lot of times these demographics have changed. But what would you say are the demographics kind of moving in to these homes? Are they already a young family that's moving in, or are they middle age? Like, can you kind of explain about the tenants that are going into these units?
Yeah, I mean, it could be across the board. Obviously, I just explained Mrs. Main at 75. Right. But you know, typically speaking, the individuals who live in our lease purchase homes are families who have children at home. And so, again, it's driving the need for the 3 or 4 bedrooms. Most cases, not in all cases, but in most cases, you know, there's an interest early on that, you know, they do want to own a home at some point in time. And they, you know, they want to build up equity. And I mean, I think that's the other reason why, you know, they pursue, you know, renting a house like this, which ultimately could be, you know, their own. Otherwise, they, you know, they could move into a larger apartment you know, if it's something that they could afford. You know, it's really been a combination of both. But I would say in most cases, family focused.
What do you think is really the future of lease purchase? So we're kind of at that beginning stage of them hitting year 15. What do you see for the future of it?
I think it depends upon the unique community. Like I said, Cleveland has done a good job with that, but it's been a real partnership between CHN, the city of Cleveland, lending partners, et cetera, and a lot of what they've done. In fact, we've had them come down and talk to us about, you know, what makes it successful for them is the approach they've taken to doing it. But we probably don't have all the same things working together in Columbus that they do in Cleveland. You know, we look at, I'm not sure it would be our priority. We review development opportunities. Lease purchase is not at the top of our list. But as I said before, one of the issues we're, you know, kind of working with is that's where the land banks have most of their properties, right? They're single family properties. So there's some interesting things emerging here in Columbus. The Franklin County Land Bank is actually pursuing creating a land trust. Mm-hmm. Now, that could change the game. Right. And they're not necessarily lease purchase, but we could still play a role working together with the land trust to be a developer of those homes. And so I don't want to walk away from single family homes, but the lease purchase model can be a difficult one just because of the time period attached to it and the changes that happen over that time period.
And so kind of moving on to the next kind of topic, I mean, you've built a lot of homes, you're involved with a lot of different types of homes, whether that be more lower income housing or the workforce housing or the lease purchase housing. But why don't people really want this type of housing in their backyard or even their neighborhood?
Yeah, I think there's a number of different reasons. So to me, you know, we hear the word NIMBYism, and the first thing we think about are personal feelings about things. And whereas that's maybe a piece of it, maybe in some cases, I think there's all kinds of other things that, you know, all lend itself to this. I mean, so first and foremost, like at the end of the day, people are living in neighborhoods. They want to be certain that, you know, the property values that they have aren't impacted in some negative way. Well, you know, there have been studies that have shown that actually it's been supportive of that. We build quality housing. I mean, we don't build a house that I wouldn't be proud to live in. So we build quality housing. Production builders build our houses. You know, they're really well done. And we try to fit the neighborhood. So, you know, we try to deal with it on that end. In many cases, in communities, the zoning and density regulations are a form of NIMBYism, if you will, because they really force the type of development that goes into a neighborhood. And in fact, I would say in many cases, you know, the zoning and density issues are maybe even a bigger issue than the individuals and their issues. And I'll get back to that in just a second. And lastly, the economics. If you think about it, particularly in the city of in Columbus, in the region, and you go start to go outside the city of Columbus and into the suburbs, most of the property tax that individuals pay support their schools. This is not just an issue for us as an affordable housing developer, but the market rate developers see the same thing. Developments have to throw off incrementally enough new sales tax to pay for the next child going into the school system. And so what's happened is it's created almost a floor for land costs, a floor for value of the real estate would be prices. And so we have all these things kind of all working together. It's a difficult process. I mean, you know, so if I kind of take each one of those, first the personal issues, the best way to deal in any of these have been with facts. In fact, you know, we've been working on a project that we would hope to start breaking ground on soon. But interestingly enough, when you compare the incomes of the individuals who would qualify to move into that community, the overlap to the incomes who actually either work or live in that same community, pretty strong. In this case, it had a hospital. We outlined what, you know, the average hospital worker was making, teachers, policemen, firemen. When you can start to have that kind of discussion, I mean, who doesn't want the teacher to live in a good place, right? And so, but you have to get it to that point. Right? As maybe emotional and passionate as we are about what we do, the other side's just as emotional and passionate about what they do. And so we have to find ways to get common ground. And that's where relationships and relationship management comes all about. Our first discussion needs to be, let's understand what each of us are trying to do. So that's number one. Number two, you know, the zoning and density issues have been interesting. Again, in one of the suburbs that we won a tax credit award for, you know, we specifically looked for a property that we didn't have to make any zoning or, you know, any changes to, that we didn't need any votes passed, at least on zoning. Now, having said that, when we sat down with the neighbors, you know, were they completely happy with the, you know, the way the project was laid out and the, you know, the way it looked and everything? No, but it gives us then the invitation to sit down and say, what would you like? If we could create it a different way or we can move some things around, we're very open to doing that. But then in turn, we need your help in supporting a variance that might be needed, right? Again, it's trying to get to down to that level where we're both trying to help each other get what we want, if you will. Economics, I'm not sure yet. We don't know what we can do for that one yet. We continue to work on it. You know, the interesting thing is that a third of the Franklin County residents have incomes lower than 200% of the poverty level. Right, so that's like, what, $49,200 or so for a family of four? Well, that's a lot. And HomePort, along with our peers 3 or 4 years ago, created Housing Alliance. One of the first things we did was some research. And what we found was that with the exception of three suburbs in central Ohio, the rate of poverty was growing faster than income rates or population rates. And so as much as in some cases the suburbs don't want to acknowledge they have an issue, they do have an issue. And we're not the only ones, you know, having that discussion, right? So that means we do need to reach out to organizations like the Columbus Partnership and Columbus 2020 and other economic development agencies to get in the mix of what's needed for and what's good for Central Ohio.
I know you've discussed it in different ways, but it's just kind of answering the question, like, how do you really sell the suburbs on affordable housing, though? I mean, I know you said that to get out there, you were really looking for the perfect site so that you don't have to deal with the zoning issues and that being the cause of it not being developed. But how do you really deal with the suburbs, or even maybe not even the neighbors, but the city council, the government that is providing these votes for the housing to go in?
Yeah. So first of all, I guess I wouldn't describe it as selling it to the suburbs. Okay. What I would describe it as is trying to understand what their unique issues are, which means we constantly have to be out talking to the organizations. You know, there are some suburbs who are just great to work with. And, you know, one here in Central Ohio is the City Whitehall. We've developed two major developments, senior developments, just finished one last year. They want us to build now a third, and adjacent to that, they want us to do a workforce deal. And they're very thoughtful. This is not to say that most of the suburbs aren't thoughtful, but they're very thoughtful about, you know, the kind of development and the mix of development they think they need in their community. In other cases, you know, it's examples like I just talked about, and that is, you know, I wasn't trying to sell anything to the community. We had to find a piece of land that we didn't need variance or zoning. But having said that, you know, I went down and talked to the mayor. It was a very interesting discussion because he opens a file in front of him, and in that file are some Excel spreadsheets, and it listed all the not just affordable, not just LIHTC funding, but I would call them, you know, affordable housing communities or apartment communities in the area. And he knew the rents for every 1, 2, and 3 bedroom. And I remember him telling me, Bruce, don't let anybody ever tell you that we're not interested in affordable housing. We're just interested in working together. You know, if I can get an opening like that, now we can have a discussion. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't necessarily mean we're going to get everything we want, but at least we can have a discussion. But, you know, then on the other end, we have communities that, you know, are, it's very interesting. We're getting some communities that are getting a good amount of new companies coming in, particularly companies that would be very prone to having employees that would need workforce or affordable housing, but they just don't want that extra housing. They just don't want housing for whatever reason, right? It, because whether it's zoning or whether it is they have such an issue they're trying to deal with from an economics perspective with their school system, that it just creates a lot of issues. They'll take senior housing because right. It doesn't put stress on their school systems, right? But family housing creates a different discussion. And so, you know, it's just working through those issues with them, and we're not going to win everything. And so I wouldn't use sell is the right as the word that we would use.
Yeah. Well, thank you. So after everything that we've kind of discussed today, what are some of the major takeaways that you want our listeners to know about?
So I would say first and foremost, just I want kind of attainable housing. So whether it's, you know, affordable, whether it's subsidized or whether it's non-subsidized, it is absolutely critical for the growth of this economy here in Central Ohio. And the bright spot for me is there are a lot of supporters who think the same thing. You know, we can't attract the type of businesses, we can't continue to grow unless we have housing across the, you know, across the income spectrums. And there's going to be some things we're going to have to figure out. I'm really excited about you know, again, the work we've done with the Alliance, one of the outcomes of the Alliance is going to be a public-private partnership around a funding pool to help finance some of the housing that's needed. And so I'm really excited about that. So things are coming. They may not all be here right now, all in place, but if the community is going to grow, it's absolutely essential.
Yeah. And so finally, if you could have everybody read one book, what would it be?
So the book that struck me the most was The Well-Tempered City by Jonathan Rose. Jonathan's one of us. He's a developer, a very successful developer at that, and he's done a number of different things. But what I found fascinating about the book, and it was really kind of almost a history and then a look forward of communities or municipalities that have not only why they succeeded, but then why they failed, and then what can we learn from that going forward? There needs to be, you know, a strong combination of economic development. There needs to be a connection between transportation and housing. There needs to be a strong urban environment. It can't all be, you know, urban sprawl in a community. There needs to be a strong central city. And then there needs to be that connection point between, you know, the housing community, the government, the transportation community, and the corporate community, all working together in, you know, in kind of one way. So I thought Jonathan's book was just, you know, right on. And will we be able to get there? I'm not exactly sure. But I think if there is any book I'd have corporate city leaders read, as well as my peers in the development space, it would be this book.
No. Thank you. I'll have to check that out. Thank you so much for coming in and speaking to us about the topics that we discussed. So to my listeners, please be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe to the Doorstops podcast so that you don't miss any updates about housing issues in Ohio. You can also follow the podcast and other research that the Office of Housing Policy at the Ohio Housing Finance Agency does by following our Twitter account at Ohio Doorsteps. Well, thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Cody Price, and this is Doorsteps.